Good afternoon. Welcome everyone, including our webinar participants, to the CSO's Property and Native Title Law Practice Group's client seminar. My name is Jodie Dennehy and I'm the director of the practice group, and I'm going to be chairing today's session. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation on whose land we meet today. I pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and also to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples here today. So, in the course of the transaction and litigation work the Property and Native Title team undertakes, we frequently come across matters involving a proposed acquisition of land where there is an Aboriginal land claim or the possibility of native title interests in land. Our clients often ask us, well, what can we do, or what's the proper course of action to ensure that the acquisition takes place validly? So today's seminar is about bringing our experiences of those matters to you over the course of three presentations. Firstly, we will discuss the things you need to know about Aboriginal land claims and native title in the context of a proposed acquisition. Our second presentation is about what you need to know about compulsory acquisition procedures. And finally, we will look at the vexed question of the valuation of native title and a very brief overview of the outcome of the High Court decision of Timber Creek, which fortuitously, or not, was handed down just this morning. Our first presentation is essentially about the due diligence you need to do when proposing to acquire land, and what are the options when an Aboriginal land claim or a native title interest affects land. This presentation will be given by Louise Darcy, a senior solicitor in our team. Louise has over 12 years' experience as a government lawyer, advising and representing government agencies across property and native title matters. In particular, she also negotiates Indigenous land use agreements between state parties and native title applicants, and also appears in the federal court in claimant and non-claimant proceedings and mediation. And her experience also extends to property transactions in relation to Crown land. Now, before we start, just a couple of housekeeping notes. So our speakers will take questions at the very end of the seminar rather than after each presentation, so we can actually get through all the presentations. There'll be a roving mic and we ask that you please use that so that our webinar participants can actually hear the question. And if you could state your name and the agency that you're from. Kindly switch off your mobile phones or put them on silent. In the case of emergency, the exits are located at the back. I've been asked, I feel a bit like a hostie at the back. We will distribute papers at the end and the slides at the end, so they'll be emailed out to everyone. And finally, please join us for light refreshments at the end, and you can also talk to our speakers then. I'll now hand over to Louise.
Thank you, Jodie. Hello, everyone, and thank you for coming along today. This first presentation will deal with the period before a compulsory acquisition takes place, and the questions that you as an agency or department, or as somebody who is advising an agency or acquiring authority might ask. This is in the context of the Aboriginal Land Rights Act and when native title may exist in the land. It's important for those of you who are considering compulsory acquisition to think about these things early on in the process, and certainly when you're trying to identify the relevant interests. And certainly Paul Rankins is going to speak about the processes later on in his presentation. At its most basic, the questions can be reduced to those on the screen. So is the compulsory acquisition of land, council land, permissible? This question is applicable for both Crown land and land council land. Is the compulsory acquisition permissible where there is native title existing in the land? And this applies to Crown land, but native title can also exist in land vesting in a land council. We will look at these questions in a moment to consider why they're relevant to you after briefly introducing the concepts and then moving on to the more practical steps that might be taken. So what do we need to know about the status of Aboriginal land or native title to allow an acquisition? I want to start with land for which the Aboriginal Land Rights Act has relevance. So firstly, land vested in an Aboriginal land council cannot be acquired by compulsory acquisition except by an Act of Parliament. This is set out in section 42B of the Aboriginal Land Rights Act. Now, in cases where the land council is the registered proprietor, it's a fairly simple matter to determine if the land vests in them. You would obtain a current title search from Land Registry Services or a search provider. However, the question becomes a little unclear where Crown land is claimed under section 36(1) of the Aboriginal Land Rights Act. Now, I'll only talk about this in general terms, and I have set out that provision in the paper. We should also consider where the relevant land council has appealed a decision of the Crown Lands Minister to refuse a claim, and that can be on the basis that it's not claimable Crown land. Now, those Aboriginal land councils can be the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council or one of the approximately 120 local Aboriginal land councils in New South Wales. Later on, I'm going to focus on the practical steps to see if there's a land claim over land being acquired, as well as the searches needed to establish if an acquisition can proceed. Now, because of Section 42B, you cannot simply rely on the usual acquisition process, even by agreement. With acquisition unavailable, a would-be acquiring authority might consider some other agreement with the Land Council. And in fact, the Aboriginal Land Rights Act does make a provision for negotiations of agreements called an Aboriginal Land Agreement. However, Land Councils must comply with certain requirements in the Act before dealing with the land vested in them. For instance, they need to obtain approval for a dealing. A transfer under Section 36 is also taken subject to native title. And so before you go down this avenue, you need to know if the land does in fact vest in a land council. Section 42, up on the screen, defines land that is vested in a land council. So that includes land where the land council is a registered proprietor, land to be transferred to a land council under an Aboriginal land agreement, and claimable Crown land that is yet to be transferred. To ascertain if land vests in a land council, you would firstly obtain a title search, which would show the current registered proprietor. If the land council is noted in the first schedule, you can be confident that you're dealing with land for which Section 42B must be considered, and some alternative agreement should be struck. The situation is a bit different where a claim has been made but not yet determined, or where it's been appealed to the court in the case of a refusal by the minister, or as Section 40 contemplates, if the land was determined to be claimable, and that can be either by the minister or by the court, but the transfer hasn't yet taken place. Now, this happens quite frequently where survey is required. In those cases, the title would still be in the name of the Crown. So that's just a basic introduction to the concepts for Aboriginal land. I now want to move on to some of the more specific things you need to know, including searching. So after you obtain a title search and it appears that you're dealing with Crown land, the first step will be to find out if a claim has been lodged. Now that search is undertaken with the Office of the Registrar, Aboriginal Land Rights Act, and there's the form on the screen. And a response will be received currently in the form of a letter detailing whether the land is affected by a registered claim. If there's no claim on the register, you can rely on that information, but of course the currency would be compromised if a claim is registered after that date. Where there is a registered claim, it's suggested by the Office of the Registrar that you contact the relevant land council. And the response from the office should indicate which is the correct entity, as there are 120 of these. Another thing to know about land appearing on the register is that it's only generally reflective of the current status of the land claim process. Now, more often than not, you're dealing with a claim that has been waiting to be determined by the minister, and in some cases, the claim will have been on the register for a number of years. But sometimes a claim will have been recently granted or refused. Maintaining the register is one of the statutory functions of the office, But if the office has not been notified to update the register, the information will not be current. And of course, a claim may have been refused and then appealed to the Land and Environment Court, in which case it should still appear as a registered claim. Some questions to keep in mind when thinking about searching are up on the slide for you to consider. Now, we've dealt with the first two. In the case where you have an undetermined claim, apart from searching the land claim register, other investigations can be made that might give an idea of the merits of the claim. As I mentioned, and many of you will be familiar, land claims are made under Section 36 of the Aboriginal Land Rights Act over Crown land. Land which does not satisfy any one of the six limbs of Section 36 will not be claimable, and that includes lands that are lawfully used or occupied at the date the claim is made. It includes lands that are needed or likely to be needed for public purpose, and so on. Before the Minister determines any claim, an investigation of the land would be undertaken by Crown Lands. This would usually disclose things such as the tenure held by an occupant, how the land was used at the date of claim, and the extent, possibly, of any use or occupation. If an agency or local council is involved, the department would make inquiries of those bodies, including if the land was needed for an essential public purpose at the date of claim. Now, the contact details for the Land Claim Investigation Unit are published on the Department of Industry's website. You could then determine if a direct negotiation with the Land Council would be appropriate, and you may even ask them to withdraw a claim, for instance. Okay, to recap, Section 42B may prevent the compulsory acquisition of land, and so other agreements might be looked at. Remember that a transfer under Section 36 of the Aboriginal Land Rights Act may still be subject to native title. And I should also mention that for land to be claimable, it can't be affected by a registered native title application or an approved determination of native title unless that saying native title is extinguished in the particular land. Finally, due diligence searches should be done before the acquisition process is commenced. Now, the Registrar General may record an approved determination of native title or any other native title matters on the register under Section 12C of the Real Property Act, but you should be aware that that is not always done in practice. Now we've come to the point where we can look at options available to an acquiring authority. If there's no interest, the compulsory acquisition can proceed as usual. Where the Land Council does have an interest in land, you might look at negotiating an agreement directly with them. This could mean having the land claim withdrawn if it's undetermined. Such an agreement could be an Aboriginal land agreement under the Act or another direct agreement, such as a purchase agreement. However, there are some restrictions on land councils dealing with land vested in them, and they must comply with the land dealings regime in the Aboriginal Land Rights Act, including obtaining relevant approval. Now I'd like to quickly introduce some of the things you need to know about native title, including that a compulsory acquisition would extinguish any native title existing in Crown land. The traditional rights and interests of Aboriginal people in land and waters, which we now know as native title rights and interests, may be extinguished by acts that are inconsistent with their continued existence. For instance, the grant of a freehold would have extinguished native title in land. Native title is not able to be extinguished contrary to the Native Title Act. So importantly for you, unless the Federal Court of Australia has made a determination that there's no native title in particular Crown land, it should be assumed that native title continues to exist. And this is true even when there's no current native title claim over an area. As mentioned, in addition to Crown land, native title can also exist in land held by an Aboriginal land council. You're probably very aware of Section 7A in the Just Terms Compensation Act. That provision authorises an acquiring authority to also acquire native title in land. If there are registered native title claimants, and I'll discuss this when we get to searches, they will be afforded procedural rights under the Native Title Act, and Section 7A explicitly refers to that process. Those rights include the right to negotiate or the right to be consulted about acts that affect native title. The note to Section 7A sets out the relevant procedures under the Native Title Act. Now, the first one on the screen can apply to certain compulsory acquisitions of native title rights and interests. The next procedure deals with acts that pass the freehold test. And the last procedure deals with Indigenous land use agreements, which can include a surrender of native title. Now, there's more information on this in the second part of the paper, and the Crown solicitor can provide advice specific to client needs. For today's purposes, though, it might be sufficient if you take away the concept that if you comply with the relevant procedures, the compulsory acquisition affecting native title will be validated under the Native Title Act. So, is there native title? Where a native title applicant seeks to have native title recognised, this is referred to as a claimant application. This is made by Aboriginal people who purport to be native title holders. A native title determination application needs to pass a registration test to be registered on the National Native Title Register. And there are two stages that you need to know about in relation to native title claimant applications. The first is where an application has been made but not yet registered. And the second is where an application has been successfully registered. Searches may be made for both types of application. The Tribunal website has information about current claimant applications and determinations that have been made, and also the related decisions of the court. At present, there are three search registers, one for native title claims, another for determinations of native title made by a court, and a third for Indigenous land use agreements. The Register of Native Title Claims shows current claimant applications that have passed the registration test. That is, after being filed in the federal court, they've been tested by the registrar or her delegate and passed the conditions set out in the Native Title Act. One of those conditions is to satisfactorily identify native title, the native title area, so that will be relevant if you've got particular land in mind. While the application remains on the register, the native title claimants have those procedural rights. One of the things to know is the basic search function on the Tribunal's website. This allows you to search by Federal Court Proceedings Number or the Tribunal File Number. And you can also search by local government area, and that information you'll find on a title search. So you can easily see if certain land falls within the boundaries of a claimant application. In the example on the slide, you will see that the local government area we're in at the moment has no registered native title claims. But if we search Singleton Council as one example, you will note three results. The National Native Title Register provides a similar search facility for determinations made by the court. The next register is the National Native Title Register. This register shows where the court has found native title to exist and contains information including the determination date and, of most interest to you, the land and waters covered. It will also show determinations that native title does not exist, and so that can be very relevant to an acquiring authority as well. I haven't shown it in a slide, but there's a similar search for Indigenous land use agreements. Now, that register provides information about the terms of the agreement and certain statements, including about the surrender of land and waters intended to extinguish native title. I won't go into the mapping tool that you can access through the Tribunal's website, but there is a function to overlay the register information on a map, and that can be helpful to show if particular land is affected by a claim or a determination. That's called native title vision. Some of you may have used it. Finally, you should request a search of the Tribunal registers by submitting the form shown on the screen. And you should do that even if you think that the land may only be near the boundaries of the claim after conducting your own online searches. The extracts and schedules available on the registers are often very helpful. And the example on the screen relates to a determination that native title does not exist in particular land. The online search functions are very straightforward, but you are still advised to submit a form for a search of the native title register using that form on the last slide. So to recap native title, we know that an acquiring authority can acquire native title pursuant to Section 7A of the Just Terms Compensation Act in the same way that other interests in the land may be acquired, but it must comply with the relevant procedures. Searches of the registers may be made, but absent a determination that native title does not exist in land, we should assume that it may continue. So where to then? The ultimate question is, has native title been extinguished? Extinguishment analysis will need to be performed, and this is where legal assistance will be indispensable. Analysis might include materials such as early Crown grants, government gazette notices, historical searches, and deposited plans. You should also know that the providence of searches is important, and searches should be made using an approved information broker. Some organisations choose to undertake these searches themselves, and there are several approved information brokers in the market for you that you can call on. A current list is published on the Land Registry Services website. However, as mentioned, a legal analysis needs to be applied to the search results so that the relevant interests can be appropriately identified. And so even if you choose to do the searches yourself, and it's a good exercise in due diligence to have someone familiar with the area of native title to consider the tenure material. I would like to conclude with some practical tips. As mentioned, some organisations are happy to commence searching themselves and then brief on for legal advice. Others may prefer referring the due diligence process when requesting the initial advice. The Crown Solicitor has a team of paralegals expert in undertaking the relevant searches, but there are some practical tips that will assist if you want to search yourself. I've already mentioned the use of approved information brokers, and these can provide a number of land registry services products. LRS also publishes a fee schedule on its website, and that's based in part on Schedule 1 of the Real Property Regulation. So keep in mind that the status of land to be acquired may change with the passage of time, and sometimes even a day can make a difference when a claim just comes on. It may be prudent to obtain searches as close to the acquisition date as possible, and this may mean performing the same searches twice. Where an agreement with the Aboriginal Land Council is contemplated, you will need to ensure compliance with the Aboriginal Land Rights Act, as dealing with the land may be void otherwise. And you should be aware that land held by an Aboriginal Land Council may be subject to native title. So to wrap up, you should bear in mind that compulsory acquisition is one option for agencies to acquire land. The paper sets out further information about other possible options you might like to consider. The earlier you think about the status of Aboriginal land and native title, the better placed you will be to determine the right steps to take for your project. And that concludes my talk. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Louise. And we'll take questions at the end, as I mentioned earlier. So in our second presentation this afternoon, we will hear from Paul Rankins, another senior solicitor in our team, regarding procedural aspects of compulsory acquisitions, which was highlighted in the last year in the recent Desane decision. Paul's practice includes valuation appeals in the Land and Environment Court and New South Wales Court of Appeal, as well as defending claims for compensation pursuant to the Land Acquisition Just Terms Compensation Act. With over 20 years' experience in litigation, he has the conduct of a wide variety of complex commercial litigation and property matters in the Supreme Court, and has also conducted matters in NCAT, including on behalf of the Chief Commissioner of State Revenue. So I'll hand you over to Paul.
Thank you, Jodie. So you want to acquire some land. How do you go about it? How do you get from this point A to that point B where you issue your notice of acquisition? You're no doubt familiar with the Just Terms Compensation Act, and that obviously sets out some procedures as to how you might go about that. Those procedures might seem straightforward at the outset, but like anything, if you put a foot wrong, you're going to end up in a little bit of trouble. So in our roadmap of my discussion with you today, I just want to cover a couple of topics. You'll see I want to touch briefly on some of the issues as to the interest that you might want to acquire, the particular land that you are interested in acquiring. You might then need to consider whether you have the power to acquire that land. Once you've satisfied yourself that you've got the power to acquire the land, how are you going to go about it? The procedures, the process. Part of those processes would touch on, as I intend to do, a Section 30 agreement under the Just Terms Act. And if agreement fails, then you turn to your compulsory processes under that Act. Turning then to that first part of our roadmap, what interest in land are you wanting to acquire? Well, the Just Terms Act, rather simplistically, defines land as including any interest in land. Interest, in turn, is defined as meaning a legal or equitable interest in the land, or an easement, right, charge, power or privilege over, or in connection with the land. The key point here is the breadth of these definitions and the scope of what may be acquired. Interestingly, under Section 32 of the Just Terms Act, you can also acquire an interest that you didn't previously have or that didn't previously exist. This would allow you to be very specific about the particular interest you are acquiring. You'll find I give some examples in the paper after the seminar of some of the rights that have been considered to be interests and some that haven't. But I'll take you now through three scenarios showing what I mean about identifying exactly what type of interest you need to acquire. Scenario one, for example, is one that many of you will be familiar with, and that's the acquisition, perhaps, for the purpose of a light rail corridor. In this scenario, there are two clear things that an acquiring authority may need. Absolute ownership of the land for the rail corridor and the stations. Secondly, temporary occupation of land on either side of the rail corridor for construction purposes, construction depots. In these circumstances, the relevant interests that an acquiring authority would probably need to acquire would be, firstly, the freehold interest, obviously, for the rail corridor and the stations, and secondly, a leasehold interest in terms of the land for the construction compound. Given that the leasehold interest would be created by the acquisition process here, you'd be engaging that Section 32 of the Just Terms Act, which allows the acquisition of an interest in land that didn't previously exist. In that situation, what would happen in practice is that a copy of the lease would probably be annexed to the gazette notice giving effect to the acquisition. Scenario two might involve a large cross-country overland water pipe, let's say for stormwater. The acquiring authority in this instance wants ongoing access to the pipe for maintenance and repairs, but wouldn't necessarily want to spend the money required to acquire the land outright. In these circumstances, the authority would be looking at acquiring an easement right over the relevant land. An easement would mean that the underlying land remains in the ownership of the landowner, but that the authority would have an enforceable legal right to run the pipe across the landowner's land and access the pipe for maintenance and repairs. A third scenario might see an acquiring authority acquire land for an underground tunnel for a roadway. A substratum right would be all that's required to be acquired. The Roads Act specifically contemplates such a situation under Section 259. As an aside, Section 62 of the Just Terms Act, compensation would not be payable, unless the surface of the land is disturbed or the support for that surface is destroyed. So there you have three particular scenarios or three particular examples of interests in land that an acquiring authority may wish to acquire. Once they have identified the interest they wish to acquire, they then need to turn to consider whether they have indeed the power to acquire it. Now, I'm going to put it out there that if you have a .gov.au email address, your agency is likely to have a power to acquire land. There are, in fact, some 47 statutes in New South Wales which provide a power to compulsorily acquire land. Most of the acquisitions, of course, are carried out under the Roads Act or the Local Government Act, but there are some more unusual statutes conferring such an acquisition power. For example, the Cancer Institute of New South Wales, the Community Welfare Act, the Soil Conservation Act, the Teacher Housing Authority Act. The key point I want to make here is that clearing the hurdle of actually having an acquisition power isn't difficult. The difficult part is considering whether that power is then properly exercised. So, do you have the power to acquire the interest? Here the question of proper purpose arises, and it's a matter of construction of the acquisition power in the empowering statute. Most of you will realise that the Just Terms Act itself doesn't convey the power to acquire, but that you need to look at the empowering statute of your agency for that power. You also need to carefully read that empowering statute to ensure your agency is acquiring for a proper purpose. Let's look at three examples: the Roads Act, the Education Act, and the Local Government Act, perhaps. RMS is authorised under Section 177 and 178 of the Roads Act to compulsorily acquire land for any of the purposes of the Roads Act. Under the Education Act, the Minister for Education may, for the purposes of this Act, or jointly for those purposes and purposes of or associated with public education or recreation, acquire land. Under Section 186 and 187 of the Local Government Act, local councils are authorised to compulsorily acquire land for the purpose of exercising any of their functions. That's not to say that any of these powers is more or less restrictive than any other of them. It's just that they're all different and need to be read within the context of their respective acts as a whole. Accordingly, you're going to need to carefully consider your functions as an acquiring authority and the purposes of the acquisition. One example where the power to acquire an interest in land under the Roads Act came into sharp focus was last year's Desane case. You might all recall it, RMS and Desane. The implications in that case were, at first instance, Desane argued that the acquisition was for an improper purpose. They argued the ultimate use of the land would be to provide parkland for open space, which clearly isn't a purpose under the Roads Act. Everyone agreed in the case that the acquisition by RMS for parkland would have been beyond the purposes of the Roads Act, as set out in my earlier slide, and therefore they argue it would have been an improper purpose. Another issue raised by Desane was that the RMS could not identify with absolute precision what road purposes would be carried out on its land. Desane raised the possibility that the WestConnex project might not even proceed. In respect of these points, the Court of Appeal held, the time for assessing the purpose of an acquisition is not at the time of the PAN or the proposed acquisition notice, but at the time the power to acquire the land is exercised, that is, at the time the notice of acquisition is published in the Gazette. RMS was motivated by the purpose that the property, when acquired compulsorily, would be used as a site for the construction of the interchange. The substratum of the Desane property was to be used in part for road infrastructure. The land was not planned to be used to provide open space until after the construction was completed. There was no suggestion that RMS would acquire the land if the land would not be used in the construction process of the WestConnex project. The court also went on to hold that the precise use of the Desane property for the purposes of constructing the interchange would naturally evolve over time and did not need to be identified with precision at the time the PAN was issued. There was an inherent risk that the project may not proceed, but this did not invalidate RMS's acquisition of the land. That's a brief look at the powers to acquire land and proper purpose. Let's now assume that, one, you've correctly identified the interest that you want to acquire, and two, that you've carefully read your empowering statute and you have considered the interest and that you are acquiring, in fact, for a proper purpose. The next step is to actually acquire that interest through the proper processes. So, to the left of your screen, you'll see that any land that is available for public sale, advertised on domain.com, for example, doesn't require you to have recourse to the Just Terms Act. It's to the right of your screen that you need to consider the Just Terms Compensation Act, where land is not available for public sale. So in that scenario, there are three particular ways to acquire land. I don't intend to deal with the first method, that is by private agreement to the left of those three boxes. Acquiring land by private agreement would simply see an acquiring authority ticking off its internal probity requirements, and which is usually a matter of just exchanging contracts. I really want to focus on those other two processes. Acquiring an interest in land by means of a Section 30 agreement, and if agreement fails you, acquiring an interest in the land by the compulsory process. Despite this last option of acquisition by compulsory process being available to acquiring authorities, our government is obviously trying to encourage the acquisition of land by agreement for the obvious reasons of reducing delay and acrimony between the parties. And to that end, they have introduced a new section into the Just Terms Act, Section 10A. This section came about, or is all to deal with, negotiations between the acquiring authorities and the landowners. It came about as a result of the Russell review of the Act in 2014. This Section 10A mandates acquiring authorities to make a genuine attempt for at least 6 months to acquire land by agreement before a PAN is issued. That six-month period, of course, can be shortened if the parties agree, obviously, if agreement is reached any earlier. There may be situations where the landowner, in fact, refuses to negotiate, or that landowner can't be located after reasonable inquiries are made by your agency. In circumstances of urgency also, and where the relevant ministers agree, the six-month period can be reduced unilaterally if it is impractical to have a six-month negotiating period. Note, however, that Section 10A doesn't apply to subsurface acquisitions, such as that road tunnel, or acquisitions of Crown land. I guess the assumption there is that if you're acquiring, an authority is looking to acquire Crown land, the assumption is that different parts of the state can play nicely together. But there's also a provision to the effect that nothing in Section 10A can be taken into account in a civil cause of action. So it remains to be seen just how enforceable that mandatory six-month period of negotiation really is. A decision to shorten that negotiating period was challenged recently in a Supreme Court case of Joyce and the Health Administration Corporation. His Honour Justice Fagan ultimately found that negotiations had taken place over an 8-month period, thereby making the shortening of that negotiation period unnecessary in order to comply with Section 10A. That judgment in Joyce, however, is still useful as it makes clear that there is no prescribed form or other statutory prerequisite for the commencement of the 6-month period, and that it's sufficient for an acquiring authority to make a genuine attempt to negotiate a mutually acceptable price in order to trigger the commencement of that negotiation period. The Court of Appeal in that Desane judgment I mentioned earlier provides some guidance on what should happen in the negotiating period. Specifically, the court held the content of good faith negotiations required by the Just Terms Act plainly includes the requirement upon an acquiring authority, if asked, to provide such information about an acquisition so as to permit a landowner to negotiate about sale price. Further, the court held a public authority would need to cooperate in good faith to provide such relevant information and material to the landowner as was available. That relevant information and material is likely to go far beyond the mere description of the public purpose of the acquisition. In addition to that statutory addition of Section 10A to the Just Terms Act, there has also been some administrative changes arising as a result of that Russell Review. When first notifying a landowner that their land is required for acquisition, the authority is going to have to approach the landowner in person. Acquiring authorities will also have to appoint some managers. There's a personal manager required to be appointed, and they're required to coordinate interactions between landowners and the authority. The personal manager may help landowners find new homes or premises, new schools for children, and other services to ease the experience of moving. A transaction manager also needs to be appointed, and they'd be responsible for carrying out the necessary steps to purchase the property by agreement, including negotiating compensation, preparing contracts of sale. And finally, a place manager. The place manager manages all general communications with landowners, their neighbours and communities where multiple properties are being acquired. If your negotiating then has proved unsuccessful, you might then consider turning to, if it has proved to be successful, you might then turn to record it in a Section 30 agreement. The critical thing to note here about Section 30 agreements is that entering into one means that you don't need to worry about the pre-acquisition procedures, such as issuing PANs. You also don't need to worry about the heads of compensation in Part 3 of the Just Terms Act. They don't apply. From a practical perspective, however, best practice might be suggesting that an acquiring authority issue a PAN even if they propose to enter into a Section 30 agreement. There's otherwise, you can imagine, a risk that the negotiations might fall through, and without a PAN being issued, the acquiring authority would need to start the pre-acquisition procedures from the beginning, in circumstances where there are likely to be significant time pressures to acquire that land. The big advantage, of course, with Section 30 agreements is their flexibility. As the heads of compensation in Part 3 of the Act don't apply, the compensation can be whatever the acquiring authorities and the landowners agree on, and it doesn't need to be just money. Let's look at some examples of compensation under Section 30 that we've encountered. Land might be acquired for no consideration. For example, where land must be dedicated by a developer under a condition of a development consent, as an offset or as a contribution. In these circumstances, the Section 30 agreement would usually contain a clause under which the acquiring authority, usually a local council, agrees that the relevant condition of consent has been satisfied by entering into the Section 30 agreement. You might have a land swap agreement or a land swap arrangement where instead of money, the landowner is getting other land owned by the authority in return. You could have prepayment of compensation. This is particularly useful for landowners who are relocating business premises. What's important to note here is that a Section 30 agreement still involves the acquisition being gazetted under Section 19 of the Act. The timing of the gazettal can be something dealt with by the agreement itself. So, your agreement is not possible, your negotiations have fallen down, you then turn to your last option, the compulsory process. The first step is a PAN being issued. A PAN must be issued to all owners of the land who have a registered interest in the land or are in lawful occupation of the land or have, to the actual knowledge of the authority, an interest in the land, as we defined earlier. If, as we discussed, the interest being acquired is one that did not previously exist, PAN still would need to be issued to all owners of the land who have a registered interest in that land and are in lawful occupation. The minimum period between issuing a PAN and gazetting the acquisition is 90 days. After 90 days, the authority must, as soon as practicably, either acquire that land or withdraw the PAN. If neither happens after 120 days, the PAN is deemed to have been withdrawn. So there you have it. To summarise our roadmap earlier, we've gone through what you need to acquire, the particular interest that you might identify in acquiring, what you actually need to acquire, do you actually have the power to acquire it, do you exercise that power for a proper purpose. Once you've determined that yes, you do have that power, how are you going to go about it, what process are you going to go about it, and specifically we looked at the Section 30 agreements and the compulsory process. Thank you.